From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we speak with the people who depend on the job line to get to and from work ahead of its services ending this weekend. And we hear from a Waukesha County supervisor on why he thinks the job line didn't work. Then we speak with a rising young pastor working with Milwaukee communities, from the homeless to youth groups.
I think we all see problems. Sometimes we walk over them, and sometimes we just try to, I don't even want to say fix them, we try to work on them. And I'm just a person who just want to work on a few issues that I see.
And we explore Camp Reunite, a program that gives kids with incarcerated mothers an opportunity for family bonding.
A lot of the women got up and went outside and were waiting in a row watching their kids get off the bus and watching their kids go through security. And it was just very tangible excitement and anticipation. You could tell it meant so much to everyone who got to participate in that day.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. All this week, we've been looking at the job line bus routes into Waukesha County, which will stop operating after this Saturday. The bus lines have gone by various names, but the current line is Route 57, which goes from downtown Milwaukee to stops in Menominee Falls and Germantown. The line gives people access to jobs at places like Walmart, Target, Home Depot, and many fast food restaurants in Waukesha County. After Saturday, however, the 57 will run only within Milwaukee County. WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke to passengers last week to see how the changes will impact them.
There's a unique message on the Route 57 bus these days.
Beginning Sunday, August 25th, Route 57 will no longer operate its Waukesha County extension to Menominee Falls and Germantown.
How are people feeling about the change in service? I caught up with Boo Guyton as he boarded at 24th and Walnut. He says he takes the 57 and transfers at the Red Line to get out to his job at Metro Market in Brookfield. But he says he knows a couple of guys who work out in Menominee Falls and take the 57 all the way there. And he knows the end of the line will be difficult for them.
That's gonna be real bad because a lot of people don't drive. Like, I don't drive. I'm 38 years old. Mm-hmm. I don't drive.
Listen.
I've been on transit all my life.
So. Round.
For if it was my job, that was, you know, that's going to be real bad. A lot of people are going to be out of jobs and ain't going to be able to get to work.
Soon after, Samuel Kelly also hopped onto the bus at Burleigh Roosevelt and 60th Street. He takes the 57 all the way to Menominee Falls to get to his job as a cashier at a Home Depot. Kelly says he's worked that job for almost 3 years and just got a full-time position. He explains why the job in Waukesha County is important to him.
Well, it means to me, let's see, freedom to do a lot of stuff. Because I was homeless, I got me a place now. And the job is doing pretty well. And I've done an admirable job at the job, but now, since this bus is disappearing, I have to transfer to another store just to keep my job.
But there are plenty of jobs on the route that will become harder to access, including at Walmart, Home Depot, Burger King, Menards, Fleet Farm, and the list goes on. Although Kelly won't be impacted as severely as others, that's not stopping him from getting politically active.
There's people that may try to get a petition, and I signed the last petition that they had to try to keep this bus up. It looks like it might not be enough because I don't think they have the funding for it.
The job lines were originally funded by using settlement money won by the Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope and the Black Health Coalition. They sued the state of Wisconsin and the USDOT over funding for the I-94 Zoo Interchange project. Since then, MCTS, community groups, and other officials have reached out to the state of Wisconsin and Waukesha County to see if they'd provide funding or enter into a cost-sharing agreement that would allow the extension to continue. Those efforts were unsuccessful. MCTS spokesman Matt Slyker says the segment of Route 57 that operates in Waukesha County currently serves 81 riders per day. He says, to compare, a route like the Gold Line serves 2,300 riders per day. But rider Elisa Knox says every rider should count.
It's ironic because
they say, you know, a lot of officials, politicians say they want people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and work. And they want to assume that people who are on assistance are not willing to work, but here are people that are willing to work.
Knox is a mother of three young children, and she rides the 57 to work.
I work at the Home 2 Suites by Hilton in Menominee Falls. I'm the public area attendant. I clean the lobbies, bathrooms, make sure that it smells good, everything is spotless.
She says the 57 is a vital lifeline for her right now because she can't afford a car.
I actually had was planning on getting a car with my taxes, but my elderly mother, who I live with, had some heart issues and ended up having to get a pacemaker. And so a lot of my funds were used to try to keep the household up.
But once the line ends, Knox sees few options for filling the transportation void.
May have to Uber, but I really can't afford it because I pay rent. You know, I get some child care assistance, but I don't really have the funds. I will basically be working to Uber and pay rent, and there will be nothing left.
Are you gonna lose your job?
It's possible. It's very possible.
Lorraine Moy was also riding the bus out to Menominee Falls. She works at her family's business, Harvey Moy's Chinese and American Restaurant. Moy says she knows the line is ending, but she's not sure what's next for her.
I know that already is.
And what's your take on that?
I don't like it, because I have no ride home. I have no ride home and ride to work.
So what's going to happen?
I don't know.
So it's just a whole bunch of uncertainty.
Yes.
And the riders affected aren't just traveling from Milwaukee Central City out to Waukesha County. Kaylin Ording lives in Washington County in West Bend. She's a waitress at Mykonos Family Restaurant on 85th and Capitol in Milwaukee County and uses the 57 to get there. Ording says she doesn't have a clue what she'll do when the extension stops running.
I haven't really figured out what I'm going to do about that option because they do have two freeway flyers, one that's on Watertown Plank Road that leads me nowhere near where I have to go, and one in Wisconsin, and I wouldn't even know how to get to 85th and Capitol from there.
Ording says she hopes God blesses her with a car before then, as she and many others with intercounty commutes are finding they can't depend on public transportation to meet their needs. For Lake Effect, I'm Mayan Silver.
We just heard from some of the people who depend on the job line to get to and from work, but they're just one side of this equation. For years, we've heard elected officials and business leaders say that there is a disconnect between getting people in Milwaukee who need jobs to businesses looking for employees in areas like Waukesha County. When the job line bus route ends its service into these areas after this Saturday, how will this impact businesses? Paul Decker is a Waukesha County supervisor and co-chair of the Regional Transit Leadership Council. He explained to WUWM's Latoya Dennis why the job line bus into Waukesha County did not work and why he still believes regional transit is necessary.
I believe that what happened was is that you ended up more or less forcing an issue versus letting an issue organically happen. And that is, from the time this was initiated to what happened now, the job market has changed dramatically. You have very low unemployment. You have a lot more jobs that are available probably closer in to where some of the people live. So around Wauwatosa, around Mayfair, northwest side of Milwaukee, there's better jobs, manufacturing, these types of jobs. So when you get to a lower and lower unemployment, that is going to make a difference in terms of bus ridership and other challenges. And we hear that a lot, the fact that on a fixed route line, that everything should go along that line. It doesn't quite work that way. And the further you go out, more things spread out. So it makes it a little bit tougher for a bus line to service the amount of people that they really need to make that work.
Has getting employees from Milwaukee to work in Waukesha County ever been a concern for businesses in Waukesha County?
Certainly. There's a lot of challenges for many of the businesses. I know that along Blue Mountain Road, there are a lot of businesses in retail, in the service industry, restaurants, hotels that are looking for employees. And certainly at some of the businesses in Menominee Falls say they are. We don't hear as much from them. But everybody is searching for employees at this point. And I believe that what you end up happening is that it's a how far do people want to drive for what type of job? And or how far do people want to ride for what type of job? And that's really one of the issues right now. What's being paid per hour? How far somebody has to go that distance for that job? What are the long-term prospects of that job? So as we look at that, that's really coming into our workforce development issues.
Now, when we spoke previously about this topic, you had also mentioned that people saw this line, line 57, as being transitional, right?
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think both riders as well as the businesses, when the line first came in, it was, okay, let's give it a chance. Let's see what it does. And then as it went on, the stories came out that, of course, this was just there for a certain period of time, and it was going to end. So that was meant it was transitional. It wasn't a permanent route. And I think both parties, both employees as well as the employers, were looking at how do we make this work? And then after a while, it was just, well, this is in transition. We're not picking up enough ridership. It's not really helping in case the businesses, my business, attract more employees. So they kind of let it go its own way. Most of the people on the bus line seem to be in retail type of jobs or lower skill jobs. And that, again, is not sustainable. We need to have, if people are going to use transit, it has to be people with skilled workers that are getting paid a higher wage. And once you get to that point, it's where are those jobs and what are the tasks involved with those jobs. So I think you have to have much more flexibility. And I know as a co-chair on the Regional Transit Leadership Council, that's what we're talking about. As we look to beyond current methods of getting people from one place to another, we're looking at much more flexibility. Ride share, vans, what will get people that last mile? You can go bus stop to bus stop and people can still be a mile away from the entryway to where their job is. Again, how do we work with the workforce development agencies to develop skill sets, the technical colleges? This is a much more complex issue than just one bus line. And it's not a simple thing just saying, oh, we're going to put a bus line in, we're going to get these people from A to B. It's not like that. There are so many more complexities to it. People try to make something like this simple. And I have to say, being involved in this now for several years, that transportation, transit, these issues, the headlines are one thing, the sound bites are another. But when you really get down to what we're studying at the RTLC, it's becoming much more complex. And then we look at what the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission has helped put together, a Vision 2050. And when we take that and fold that in, there are obviously going to be technology changes. There's going to be many variables. Like I said before, the last mile. How do we get people basically door to door? So we're talking with the rideshare companies. How do we incorporate them into this? You look at what Milwaukee County Transit System has just proposed, that they're looking at either shutting down or reducing almost 16 routes. And a lot of that is, what's the ridership? Where are people going? Why are they using the routes? And those are just within Milwaukee County, which has even more density than we do in Waukesha County, where our employers are. And so when you look at how do we put all those together, it's going to take some degree of, again, study and complexity and utilizing other resources than just the way we've done things in the 20th century. We've got to look much more 21st century on this. And I do believe, you know, in Milwaukee, you've got the Joseph Project, you've got other people that are trying to tackle this. Some of the businesses have put together their own van pools. That combination is going to be what we're hopefully can, at some point, what I'd like to see is an integrated transit system that is public, private, the combination. As a policymaker, you have to look at this and go, it can't be all on the taxpayers. It can't be all on just one group of people. It has to be a combination. And the employers do have to be involved.
Do you think that employers understand their responsibility in helping to transport employees?
Some do. Some are getting it. Some will get it because all of a sudden, as you just said, if they're dependent on it and it's no longer there, now what? And they'll have to get involved. And we're gladly willing to talk with them. But understanding that it's not just something you can throw at people. And I can tell you in Waukesha County, that happens where we're, how do I get people here and why aren't you doing something about it? In the meantime, don't raise my taxes. It's like, okay, well, this it doesn't work quite that way. It's a combination of us working together so it works for everybody.
You know, I was going to ask you that, you know, whose responsibility is it? Obviously, you just answered that. But I think that's a big question for people, right? Because I think we've typically depended upon public transit to solve this issue, and it's not.
No, and that's part of the reason as we look at where building is happening, both in the manufacturing sector, retail. We're starting to see more conglomeration, which I think is good. We look like the corners in Brookfield, Brookfield Square being revitalized, Mayfair, Mayfair Collection. So you're starting to see more of a coming together, a little less spread out. So as we have those places and then the routes that fill in retail or other businesses along that line, that will make some things simpler. Then we look at our business parks like you have in Franklin or Oak Creek, and how do we pull that together? You look what Oak Creek is doing with the Drexel Town Center. So there's more and more of that happening, that mixed-use development, which will increase the capabilities. It was interesting just being in Chicago over the weekend and trying to get from the south side to train station. There's no direct, and you're in a dense area in Chicago, there's no direct public transit, so you rely on either a taxi or rideshare. And as a result, that's where it has to be, but you have to have that modern convenience. You've got to be able to do it with an app on your phone. You want to have safety involved. Those are all parts of what's going to make transportation, transit in the future, work for everybody.
The thing is, you also have to be able to pay for it, though, right?
Well, and that's in talking to the rideshare companies, they are looking at different ways of doing this and spreading those costs out and looking at different ways. When you look at rideshare, some of the things they're looking at are how to combine more rides. If you look at when you do get rideshare today, you can, if you want to take it yourself, you pay X. If you want to take it with two or three other people, you pay even less. So that is going to be, again, that it's going to be its own form of mass transit at some point. And as you do that in an urban area or where jobs are, can you do vans? Can you do mini buses? I've also proposed, because being heavily involved in workforce, is how can we use those rides in the favor of the employee? And that is, how do we train people today? And employers we could utilize that bus time or that van time or that car time. If we could train people along the way, that might be a better payback for the employers as well. You know, issue somebody an iPad if they don't have one and do some of the training, customer service training. It could be done on that on the ride if they're not occupied driving. So there's more and more ways I believe we can use technology to make this all work, but it's going to take some smart planning. We have to become a smart city, a smart region in this. I believe we have the willpower to do it, but as a policymaker, we're only one piece of this. The employer's got to be involved. I think we got to get organizations that are out there on behalf of the workforce and say, how's it going to work for them? I don't know if anybody's really done a study lately of where are people, because I think since low unemployment has happened in the region, we still think that everybody's pocketed here or pocketed there. And I don't really know if that's true anymore. That's really the challenge, is where are people, where are the jobs? We do know that some people have done a really good job of transitioning from getting job force entry, and now they've upped their skills and then they move on. And we're replacing those people. So how do we keep that pipeline, building that workforce pipeline? And transit is one of the answers, but it's only one of the answers.
Are there any models out there? Like, are there places that are actually getting this right?
That's a very, very good question. And we are looking at different areas that are doing it. Columbus, Ohio is one that's very similar to Milwaukee in terms of size and some of these same issues. And you have a urban-suburban type of spread out. There are places that have taken on the challenge. I don't know if anybody has the perfect answer right now, and I'm always weary about doing direct comparables, but I think if you at least we're studying to look at, okay, what are some of the options? But you have to understand the Milwaukee metropolitan area has some unique, very, very unique challenges. We all know what they are. We've got to overcome those. Part of it is psychological. Part of it is physical. Part of it is just do we have the will? And do we understand that for our sake of economic development and the long-term the economy in this area and the long-term prosperity of our entire area, this is one of the things we're going to depend on, is how easy are we to connect people to where the jobs are and how do we increase that connectivity? Because as we do that and make it easier and accessible to all, that will smooth things out and that will take care of some of these other issues. I truly believe that. It's been proven psychologically. If people are working, they feel better about themselves. If you give them hope and prospects that it's not just that first job, it's the ongoing progress in your life, we've got to make that happen.
And just for clarity, when you talk about the unique issues, I'm assuming you're talking about the level of poverty and segregation and such.
Well, segregation is definitely one of it. I think that you can't say much about this issue if you don't want to tackle that. But I also look at, how do we utilize schools? What are we using as far as excuses? Because if a student doesn't come to school ready to learn because of whatever the challenges are, that's not unique to Milwaukee Public Schools. You talk to the school districts in the surrounding area, everybody has a certain percentage of students that are just, and how, we cannot afford to have them fall behind.
Paul Decker is a Waukesha County Supervisor and co-chair of the Regional Transit Leadership Council. He spoke with WUWM's Latoya Dennis. We'll be wrapping up our series of conversations on the job line bus routes tomorrow with a look at what's next for public transit in our region. You can find more of the stories featured in the series at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we speak with a rising young pastor working with Milwaukee communities. We meet Andre Pirtle when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A day in the life of Andre Pirtle can range from delivering water to Milwaukee's homeless, leading youth groups at Emmanuel Church in Brookfield, where he's a pastor, to working with the outreach group Street Life. Not yet 30 years old, Pirtle has dedicated his life to serving Milwaukee's communities and lifting people out of the pressures that he once faced himself, whether it's as a social worker, a pastor, life coach, or at times a first responder. Pirtle says it all comes down to connecting with someone through conversation. He joined me in the studio for a conversation about his work, which was featured in a profile in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. Andre Pirtle, welcome to Lake Effect.
It's awesome to be here on this semi-warm day. I'm happy to be here.
We're happy to have you in here. So you are the feature in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. It describes you as a pastor, social worker, life coach, first responder, lots of descriptions, lots of jobs. How would you say you describe yourself?
Honestly, I'm just a kid from Milwaukee. Like, I don't think there's anything special about me. I think we all see problems. Sometimes we walk over them, and sometimes we just try to, I don't even want to say fix them, we try to work on them. And I'm just a person who just want to work on a few issues that I see. So, no, I'm not special at all. The people around me are special, and I think they think I am, but it's really them.
Yeah, so you're involved in a lot of different organizations, things you do on your own. So how about we give listeners a little example? What's the day in the life of Andre Pirtle?
To be honest, just being, like, straight up, it really depends on the day. I work in different communities. And different communities have different, not just cultures, but different things that are important to them, different ways of doing things, and different time frames they work. So one community, you know, they might not wake up or work until 12 in the afternoon, right? But another community might start early. So I guess it depends on the day, but this is an example of how my whole night could switch. So usually I do street life, and street life is when we work with the men and women who are homeless, men and women who are human trafficked, because it is men and women, and just work with people who don't have housing for that night, or just in general. So as I'm preparing to go there, I get a phone call saying that one of my youth group kids, and this is one that I mentor, has been in my house, has pet my dog. he's missing. And he didn't come to youth group that night, and we looked for him prior. We just thought he was at a park. So from about maybe 9:30 to maybe some point after 12 o'clock, we were looking for this kid. So that starts off my day. But because I did that, I didn't do street life. But either way it was going, I wouldn't have been out that late regardless, whether I was working with men and women we know, or if it would have just been finding Noah, which we did. And a huge shout out to Milwaukee, because a lot of people helped out. People stopped me who I didn't know and just said, "Hey, Andre, we know you from Facebook. We're looking for that kid right now."
So you did eventually find him.
Yes, and then, yes, we did.
Then did you try and like backtrack and kind of go back on the main road of where your day would have gone had you not gotten that phone call? You volunteer, you know, helping out the homeless population. You got the youth group. Mm-hmm. You're a pastor at a church. So
yep.
I imagine you are just dealing with a lot of people of all different ages, of all different situations.
I am. But it's a group of us. So I think I get a lot of credit because I'm probably the most charismatic one. And be honest, I'm probably just the youngest one. So you're supposed to pass the buck off to, or pass it off to the next generation.
Right.
I'm just a kid that they pass it off to.
Well, and on that note, being a younger activist and worker and person in the community, and having faced some of the same pressures of a lot of people you help in this city, I'm curious, where does your drive come from to be involved in this kind of work so young and to take a leadership position in it?
I think that I really believe this. I think that a lot of times people don't have a person to be solid or be consistent with them, right? And so one of the things, I learned this at an early age, I'm dyslexic. So if I didn't have somebody there every day to help me read words like and the, and even the big words at that time for me, like difficult, if I didn't have someone there every day, my life would have been dramatically different. And I want to be that. I want to be consistent in people's lives. I want to be consistent in the work I do. And if I'm just being honest about it, I believe in a higher power. I believe that what we do on earth in some way, shape, or form, and I don't know what it's going to look like in another plane, but I believe that we answer for these things. And I think that as a kid, I would spill milk. And if I would walk over that spilt milk and go outside and play, when I came home, my mom would have a few choice words for me. Why didn't you pick that up? You had the strength to do it. I think people are the same way. I think on the other side, I might be asked, "Hey, Andre, you seen that guy? He was going through something. Why didn't you talk to him?" So for me, it echoes into my afterlife, too.
What would you say is your most valuable tool or resource that helps you not just manage the challenges of your various jobs, but connect with others on that personal level? You mentioned consistency is a big point. What else would you say?
Relationships. Like, everything boils down to a relationship. Like, as much as we're dealing with, they give me the awesome opportunity to assist in their issue. They're the master of their own face. They have the keys. But the relationships we establish, they realize that I'm not necessarily dealing with their issue. I'm dealing with a person. We're working with a person. We're living life together. And, like, the relationship aspect of things, if you lose that, then everything falls by the wayside. Because it's not just, it's not a pastor just come up to you, "Praise the Lord, saints." No, it's your friend. It's a companion, someone who wants you to be better than where you are or to just see you thrive. And it's that relationship aspect of things that helps me, because a lot of times I'm not doing things alone. You know, there's people who I work with who want to work with me. So delegation is cool, but partnership is better for me. So, and that's what we do a lot. So that's out of relationships.
You first got a little spark of the counselor life at a YMCA summer camp.
Yes.
It was one of your first introduced.
Yes,
so
yes.
Did you think that first summer of doing that would spark your journey to becoming a pastor, becoming a community activist?
No, not at all. I think that, like, so I got out of my neighborhood because there were things going on in my neighborhood.
The Woodlawn neighborhood, right?
Yep, the Woodlands, yeah.
Yeah, Woodlands.
There were things going on at that time that I had no business being a part of. and I just needed escape. I think we all need a break, whether that's mentally or physically. And I got out, but it gave me like this awesome opportunity to just experience people. I think it's different when people, when they believe in you. And I had a group of people who believed in me. And I think that sparked all of this. But even like just being in nature, it sparked the conversation of, you know, do I have purpose? Is there a higher power? And if it is, what's my role? But I never expected to be a pastor. I laugh about it some days and I cry about it some days. I never saw it. I never saw this even being a possibility. So it wasn't like plan A, B, or C. No, it was like, it wasn't even on the radar. It wasn't even one of the alphabetical letters for me. So
what were you most nervous or concerned about when you first started counseling at YMCA? You know, any of this stuff came, what was your main concern?
It was the first time, actually the second time outside of babysitting and my sister, it was the first time that I was responsible for a life. And if something happens to this child on my watch, then, you know, I got to own that. You know, not just with the parents, but even in my, you know, with my self-esteem. So I was nervous of teaching the kids the wrong thing. Because I didn't always know what the parents taught. And I don't want to do anything counterproductive to what a parent is teaching their child. But I also didn't want my goofy 17-year-old tendencies to rub off on a 12-year-old. And they're doing the things I'm doing because I'm unsure of who I am. So I just didn't want to lead kids in the wrong direction. That's honestly still one of my biggest fears, leading people in the wrong direction.
Well, and as a, you know, a pastor, you work at Emmanuel Church, yep. And mentoring obviously played a big role in your life when you took on that mantle, but also the people who have helped you. And I want to touch upon Max Ramsey real quick. So he's the one who kind of brought you into the church and helped shape your role as a pastor. So how has the relationship with him influenced what you do, how you view things in a different perspective with your work?
You know, I can say so much about Max, you know, Max is one of my best friends. I love this guy, you know. And he's influenced me in so many different ways where the literature I read, my viewpoint, I dress better than him, so not style. But he's had such a big impact on my life. Not too often do you get, you know, people who are set in their career. Like, Max didn't need to help me out, if we're being honest. Max could have retired. Max could retire right now and his legacy is beautiful, but to be honest, he gambled on me. He gambled on a kid from the inner city, but it went back to that camp mentality. I don't want to let this guy down. And not just him, but my father. Max and my father know each other, you know, and there's a mutual respect. And I just didn't want to let this guy down, but he saw something in me that sometimes I still struggle to see in myself, and he believed in me, so he's a huge influence on my life. Huge. He's Batman and I'm Robin.
So it seems that, you know, you often are interacting with at-risk, transient populations, kids who need that mentor in their life, that support, that person who is consistent. What are the biggest misconceptions about the people you reach out to and work with every day that you'd like the public to push aside?
Laziness. People aren't, I think that the population of people I work with, one of the populations, they are assumed to be lazy. And I don't think people understand the effects of generational, being broken down for generations. Example, so if your grandfather went to college, or maybe he didn't, maybe went to a trade school because of the era, right? Odds are your father or your went to college, right? So odds are you'll go to school. But what if your grandfather was disenfranchised and had no wealth to pass down to the son? And the father was never able to pass that down to you. So I think a lot of times we inherit things from our parents. And what happens when your parents don't have a lot to inherit to you? And I also think people have been beat down for generations to where it's hard for them to even contemplate certain things as far as, you know, making it out. You go to the things that people around you have gone to. And if no one has ever went to school, if no one has ever made it out of the neighborhood you come out of, why would you have ambitions? Because you've never even seen it happen around you to make it out. And I think a lot of times that gets confused as being lazy. And a lot of times it's just a lack of direction. And probably the biggest one, resources. If all communities had the same resources, it'll be a different ball game. But all communities don't. And I think that's a big misconception.
In the article, you're quoted as saying, sometimes it starts with a simple conversation. Mm-hmm. What kind of conversations do you think the people of Milwaukee should be having with each other?
Oh, man, redlining? What is redlining? And why does that exist? And why did it exist? And not just that, but does that still affect us today? What does poverty look like? I think conversations about the trade school should open up. I think conversations about equal pay for women should open up. I think, and probably this is a huge one, conversations about mental health. Mental health needs to be spoken about, and it's a taboo right now, and it doesn't have to be. When you get a cut in your foot, you know where to go. But when you're going through something psychologically, where do you go? And if you don't know where to go, that's what we need to be talking about. So for me, those are the things I need to be talking about. And also the homeless population, how do we support them? And what does support even look like? And that's just a few of my ideas about what we should be speaking about.
Some of these challenges and issues obviously have persisted over time, you know, such as the homeless population, poverty, gun violence here in the city. What's your greatest concern or fear if a trend continues unchanged?
If it continues to be unchanged, well, it becomes a part of our culture. That becomes the norm. When trends stay in place for a long period of time, we adapt those and say that's just a part of who we are. And I don't think that's the case in all scenarios.
With your work, you are probably out, 12 hours a day, work days?
Some days, yeah. Some days 12, some days shorter, mm-hmm. some days longer. Being honest, it just depends on the day. Between my father and Max, they've taught me it's not about the hours you put in, it's about what you do in those hours. So I can put in 24 hours in a full day, but if the job didn't get done, what's the point? If I didn't chip something off of the block, it doesn't matter. So I kind of was trained to work until completion.
How do you manage to take care of yourself in the midst of all the demands that are asked of you and the situations you go through and the emotional investment you put into your everyday?
So I got a fine wife. So hanging with her, to be honest with you. Letting people invest in me. I didn't know how to do that at first. I knew how to give, but it took me years to realize I need to receive. And I think that allowing people to do that, not denying them that, because when you deny people the opportunity to give, you deny them of sometimes their gifting. Maybe their gifting is giving. When you say no, they sit there like, what do I do now? And I think researching how to eat, I think it's therapeutic, researching history. I really love history. Working out, praying and really reading the Bible, but also, like I said, different forms of literature. So those are the things that help me out. They soothe either my mind, my body, or my spirit. So those are the things I try to keep in constant line from my perspective.
Well, I know you're certainly gifting a lot of things to people within this community, and I want to thank you, Andre, for taking a few minutes out of your day to speak with me about yourself.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Andre Pirtle is a pastor, community activist, mentor, and much more. You can read the profile piece on Pirtle, written by Zach Brook, in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. We will take one last break and then learn about Camp Reunite, a program at Tichita Correctional Institute that helps incarcerated mothers bond with their kids. Lake Effect returns in a moment here on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In the United States, more than 5 million children have had a parent in prison. And while that parent may be the one incarcerated, their family also pays a price. A program called Camp Reunite at the Chichita Correctional Institute is providing these families with an opportunity to bond and heal alongside their incarcerated loved ones. Allison Dekanovic is a reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service who has been reporting on this story. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in July, and she starts by describing what the program offers.
It's a summer camp where kids go away to camp for a whole week, and then there's two full-day visits where they get to go and visit their moms at Chichita and spend two full days with them in a really family-friendly environment.
So for people who may not know much about Chichita, what is that prison like?
Yeah, so Chichita is up. It's up in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, so it's a few hours from Milwaukee. It's in a pretty rural area. It's a large campus. And usually there are really strict security measures and protocols for when people get to visit, even when kids get to go and visit their parents there. It's all women at Chichita. It's the Women's Correctional Institution. So when kids go visit, usually they have to go through all these security measures. But for Camp Reunite, they kind of amended a lot of those rules on purpose. They wanted it to feel really natural and organic and for it to feel more just like a mother and a child interacting if they were at home. And so the moms got really excited. They had been preparing for over a month for their kids to come, and they set up a whole carnival. So they kind of turned the whole outdoor visiting area into a carnival setting, and in the visiting room they had decorations and posters and signs and arts and crafts stations set up. So it really felt like a child-friendly environment. It didn't feel as sterile as the prison usually would.
You know, as you mentioned, it was this kind of carnival setting. It was much more relaxed than your standard prison visit. And, you know, the way that mothers were able to interact with their kids is very different than they normally are able to do.
Yeah, it was some of those kind of little moments between moms and their kids that normally would be against the rules, even just like doing each other's hair. I talked to one mom who got to braid her daughter's hair, which she said she used to do every morning, but wouldn't normally be able to do in prison. And one mother and her son were playing football together and running around and throwing a football, which normally wouldn't be able to do. So just all these different kinds of interactions, even just being able to hug your mom for an extended period of time is usually against the rules. And this is what the prison warden, Sarah Cooper, had to say about why they chose to do that.
We've designed this camp to be set up like a family atmosphere, not so much like a prison visiting room. So the moms and the kids, they can walk around hand in hand. They can have their arms around each other for the whole time if they want. We really try to replicate an environment where if the kids and the moms were at home together, what kind of fun things would they be doing together?
So much of this is about reunification. And in many ways, this is also about the separation that incarceration causes. Stepping aside from really how these women responded, what is the ripple effect of incarceration, specifically on families?
That's kind of the whole focus of this camp, is working to support kids who have this experience, because it's an experience that more than 5.1 million kids in the country have a parent in either jail or prison in the United States. So 88,000 children in Wisconsin have this experience. So it's a widespread impact of mass incarceration that we don't always think about, that there are kids that are left behind. And I talked to an academic who has kind of studied the impact that that has on a child when their parent is incarcerated, and she described it as kind of a forced separation that can be a really traumatic experience for both the child and the parent, but especially for the child, that can have kind of short-term and long-term impacts on their mental health and well-being. And one of the most important things that she said to kind of help mitigate some of those negative impacts is to really maintain some kind of strong relationship with your parent who is incarcerated. So that's kind of what the point of this camp is to provide an opportunity to get to have that relationship, kind of keep that ongoing, keep that support intact, even when the parent is away from home.
Well, it's really an opportunity to have private time with your child. You know, something that we talked about was this is, for many women, the first time since their incarceration that they're able to really just sit with their children without another adult, without a grandparent, without an aunt or uncle.
Yeah, so it's difficult for some of the children to get up to Chichita to see their mom. So a lot of them don't have the opportunity to do that very often. And even if they do, like you said, that someone has to bring them there. And so there's always going to be kind of a third party around. And this was really just an extended period of one-on-one time. It was a time for kids to kind of talk with their moms and get really honest and real about some of the feelings that come when the mom is away and when she is incarcerated. And I have talked to a lot of moms and kids, moms especially, who said that was really powerful to hear more about their kids' feelings and to kind of see the moments that they don't really see every day, to even see their kids get upset and cry about something or fight with their sibling, maybe the not-so-glamorous parts of parenthood, but to be together long enough to kind of experience that range of emotions. A lot of the women said that that was really powerful and beautiful for them to get to do that.
Well, and, you know, some of the kids you mentioned were angry. They're angry at their mothers, regardless of the circumstances that put their mothers in prison. They do feel this level of abandonment. And this kind of speaks to something that the warden spoke about with you, wanting to help women transition into what will be their normal lives after incarceration.
Yeah, a lot of the women talked about that this experience was so powerful for them that they got to spend that time with their kids and feel really excited about being able to go back to them and support them and wanting to be there for their kids. And they said as much as it was painful to be away, that being able to interact with them made them really excited. And so this opportunity was kind of a motivation to keep that up and to keep doing the hard work that they're doing to better themselves and get ready to be a supportive parent again. And so this is what the warden, Sarah Cooper, said that she heard from women about what this camp meant to them.
We have ladies who have said to us, you know, I found myself in this situation where I was really, really angry with another woman and I just wanted to, you know, revert back to my old ways of managing it, whether that's violence or whatever the case may be. And then she said, but I think about Camp Reunite coming up and I think about how much this means to my kids. And I'm not going to lose this opportunity, so I didn't engage. And they say, now, all the other stuff, it just doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is spending this time with my kids.
And I feel like this quote in particular is really key to this conversation, because I think people might be looking at this camp going, well, you know, that's great for these incarcerated mothers and great for their kids, I suppose, but what does the institution really get out of it? And, you know, I think the warden really explains that here.
I think it showed a lot that the institution cared enough to do this. The women did. They told me that they really appreciated that the institution made the effort to make this possible for them. And there were different prison staff that were volunteering and were part of the day and who were working the carnival games. And everyone kind of felt that benefit. I talked to a woman who was a recreational therapist at Tichita, and she was talking about just how powerful this is for the women to get to have this time and how special it is and how healing it is for a lot of them who don't get to see their families very often. So the prison staff was very supportive of this, and they saw it as beneficial because it was beneficial to the women and beneficial to their goals of helping the women prepare to reenter society successfully and be contributing members of our communities.
Yeah. And for the kids, it seems like there's the obvious benefit of getting to spend time with their mothers, but, you know, something that we talked about a bit is, you know, the camp element of it, but also, you know, the fact that they're around a bunch of other kids who also have incarcerated mothers.
Yeah, that was kind of part of the intention behind the camp, to create this community of kids who have that shared experience. So hopefully that kids could find support among each other, and then that they could find support in their moms, but also in the camp staff. And so there were a whole wellness team of camp staff that worked on different activities and brought in music therapists and art therapists and kind of held discussions to help kids process their emotions. And then just camp counselors that are fun, that the kids could lean on and talk to if they needed to work through maybe hard feelings, or just to have a fun time at summer camp and do archery and slide down the slide and whatever. But I think just having other kids who got what you're going through, like maybe some of the kids didn't have that at school or maybe didn't talk about this experience that they had of having a parent incarcerated. So to have other kids around you that got that seemed really meaningful for a lot of the kids that I talked to. So Felicia was one of the women who I talked to, and her kids, Kayliana and Zacchaeus, talked to me about how that made them feel.
How does it make you feel being around other kids that have moms here? And how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel not lonely. I just feel normal.
You know, Kaliana, you have a video of her, but you might not be able to hear this from her voice. She's very young. She's a little girl.
She's young. She's 9 years old. Yeah, and there's a video. There's a video, and there's a lot more information than I was able to talk about here today, and the full story on MilwaukeeNNS.org, where there's a video where we hear more from Felicia and Kaliana and what this day was like for them, what this camp means for them. And
you can really see, you know, a number of the women who participated in the group and, you know, kind of their interactions during the day.
Yeah, yeah, it's really powerful. I mean, that's what the moms, one of the moms told me. They're like, this is the best versions of us. This is our mothering selves. And it was powerful for them to see each other like that. And I think, yeah, to see these other sides of themselves and to see that they are these caregivers. And it made people feel really purposeful and excited. And it's really special to see some of these moments. It's very tender moments.
Yeah, what was the experience like for you?
It was really beautiful, honestly. Even I knew it was going to be an emotional day, but when we were standing there at Tichita and the school bus pulled up in front, that the kids had arrived and a lot of the women got up and went outside and were waiting in a row watching their kids get off the bus and watching their kids go through security and kind of picking their kids out from pretty far away and saying, like, oh, he looks so tall, or she got so big, or that one's mine in the back, I can tell he's nervous, and just kind of that anticipation. And it was just very tangible excitement and anticipation. You could tell it meant so much to everyone who got to participate in that day.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Yeah, thanks so much, Joy.
Allison Tikhanovic is a reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. She spoke with Joy Powers in July, and you can read her piece about Camp Reunite at WUWM.com. You can also find more of Tikhanovic's reporting on Wisconsin prisons by going to MilwaukeeNNS.org. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.